legislation that will help those companies, reports found in July. While the loans to U.S. lawmakers certainly are helpful for their businesses, some of the biggest financial assistance from the CARES Act likely comes in the form of tax relief for so-called pass-through business entities such as LLCs. It is common for members of U.S. Congress to be affiliated with or invested in such companies, reports found. Provisions in the CARES Act allow for such companies to receive an immediate refund on losses from prior years and other lucrative tax deductions that amount to a windfall. The biggest winners will be the roughly 43,000 taxpayers with $1 million or more in annual income that will reap 82% of the benefits and get an average tax cut of more than $1.6 million. According to tax expert Steve Rosenthal, writing in Forbes, U.S. Congress could have targeted relief to the small businesses who need it most rather than millionaires and large businesses, Rosenthal argued. Of all the private companies the members of Congress are associated with, the majority, about 205 of 347, are LLCs, according to the new analysis.
From the very start, there was no doubt that the EU would not give the British a deal that would match any of the conditions met by being a member of the EU. So when Johnson and von der Leyen announced a deal had been struck, why then did the UK hail it as a victory? But with the details yet to be fully made public, many people are labelling the deal as a sham for the British, clearly suggesting that the EU negotiators, led by Michel Barnier, stood firm to the end and made sure that the EU did not come out the loser on the deal. According to one French source familiar with the exact details of the paper and who wished to remain anonymous, it seems that the British made huge concessions, giving up many of the terms and conditions they claimed that they would fight for. However, it seems that ultimately the British team had no choice but to cave in. Several days after the deal was announced, EU and British officials and lawmakers are poring over the details. The document is rumoured to be some 1,200 pages long, but once read and digested, will demonstrate just how many concessions the UK finally gave into and reveal just exactly what Boris Johnson tried to hide on announcement day.
Brexit is a disaster, an absolute disaster, and it's one that Boris Johnson is like hugely responsible for just by himself. I mean, as a journalist, he did his very best to poison the waters between the UK and the EU. He succeeded, the referendum passed, and now Britain is facing the reality, just a few days away, of a forcible separation from the continent.
What was clear from Johnson's announcement is that nothing new has come from the deal, with Britain claiming victory over its borders, freedom of movement and trade criteria, all things that, with a deal or not, Britain would have had anyway. So where then does the victory lie for Whitehall? Johnson's next task is to win over the hardline Brexiteers, many of whom who wanted to leave the EU without a deal, claiming that Britain will be fine on its own. However, it seems that Johnson may have already convinced many to fall in line, as any sign of division now by the British would send a message to the world that the deal was in fact a disaster for the UK, a message that Britain can ill afford to leak out. The British made numerous promises prior to the announcement of the deal between Britain and the EU. Some of these promises included protecting the rights of British fishermen, farmers and businesses. Yet it seems, as details slowly emerge, not all are happy about the deal. British fishermen, for one, have already started claiming that they've been sold out by Boris Johnson as they face sharing British waters with EU fishermen for the next 5.5 years, only increasing their quota from 10% to 20%, suggesting that not much will change. But when it comes to the financial value of fishing in the UK, one has to really question the fishing industry culture. With fishing making up only 0.1% of the overall British GDP, is it any wonder then that Johnson failed to push hard for a fair deal, raising the question as to just what else he folded on?
There are several. There are the question of fishing rights, which apparently he had to give more ground than he wanted to, which essentially gives the EU greater rights in the English Channel than British fishermen had wanted to grant. The other one involves business services, and that's really quite unclear as to what will happen. The agreement is 1,200 pages long, so no one at this point is quite sure what's in it.
For Johnson, and all in favour of Brexit, a long road lies ahead before the full impact of Brexit becomes clear. But what's for sure is the level of uncertainty and division that lies ahead. For a start, Scotland will no doubt seek a second independence referendum, sparking a chain reaction that will likely see the north of Ireland request to be united with the Republic of Ireland, causing a breakup of the UK, something that seems an inevitable consequence of Brexit. From the EU perspective, Britain, it seems, is a spent force, a country living in the fading memories of past glory, and slowly but surely floating further away from Europe, something that the EU, for one, will be happy to watch sinking on the horizon.
United Arab Emirates has become a trade hub in the region with strong links across West and South Asia and Europe. The country has, among other things, been trying to establish itself as a large and fast-growing marketplace for gold. According to data collected by the Observatory for Economic Complexity, the UAE's gold imports have increased by an average of 58% to over $27 billion in 2018. The Arab country's fondness for gold comes amid its plummeting oil reserves and the UAE's drive to diversify its economy. Gold has proven to be a lucrative commodity in the past months, particularly as investors favored the precious metal as a safe haven during the uncertainties in other markets as the coronavirus pandemic hit. The importance of gold for Dubai's economy is such that its trade volume surpassed that of diamonds, oil, jewelry, and cell phones in 2019.
The United Arab Emirates has no gold on its own, as is clear. They have oil, but they have no gold yet. Gold is their second largest export. So all of their 17.7 billion of their gold export is being imported first and washed or laundered by re-exporting it mainly through the UK into Switzerland and other gold refining places, like India.
But there's another side to this story. The United Kingdom's Home Office and Treasury issued a report on money laundering and terrorist financing, labeling the UAE as vulnerable to illicit activities due to a lax policing of gold movements across the country. But how does the UAE acquire all that gold? And where does the country buy the exorbitant amount of precious metal from? According to investigations conducted by The Sentry, an NGO that tracks dirty money linked to African war criminals, 95% of gold officially exported from Central and East Africa, much of it mined in Sudan, South Sudan, the Central African Republic, and the Democratic Republic of Congo, ends up in the Emirates. Gold has funded armed conflicts in the region for years, but the jump in prices in the past few months has turned the metal into new blood diamonds, as it's been increasingly obtained through brutal mining practices and illicit profits, including the use of underage workers.
First, the international gold laundering is a gigantic human rights abuse, foremost because it uses many countries in Africa, in South America, are using massive child labor. Children not only are put in tremendous risks working in the mines in narrow, rickety underground tunnels that could collapse anytime, and often do. But they are also poisoned on a daily basis by chemicals used in extracting gold from the rock.
In 2016, the UAE declared gold imports from 25 African countries worth $7.4 billion, which had not declared any exports to the UAE. The Emirates declared $3.9 billion more in gold from most of the 21 other countries it imported from than was declared in exports.
Gold laundering is an international crime because it is mostly run by mafia-type organizations, where killing and other type of violence, plus sexual abuse of women, forced prostitution, are a daily occurrence. It's actually the law of the day, you could almost say, in these illegal gold mining areas. There should be an international law enforceable, issued by the UN, if at all possible, and enforced, must be enforced, by the International Criminal Court against anything to do with gold laundering.
Gold's small size and high price make it a suitable target for smuggling, and the UAE's minimal control and regulations have turned the country into a magnet for the metal. The situation has become so dire that the London Bullion Markets Association called on Dubai and other gold hubs to conform to the regulatory standards or face a blacklisting of their exports. While the UAE has promised more transparency, only time will tell how and to what extent the country will fulfill its pledge.
The U.S. is facing another crisis thanks to the actions of the U.S. President Donald Trump. This time, it has to deal with a massive COVID-19 relief bill. Donald Trump said that he is unhappy with the massive bill, which provides $892 billion in coronavirus relief, including extending special unemployment benefits. $1.4 trillion is also needed for normal government spending. The U.S. President said that he is not signing it, in part because that one-off $600 stimulus checks for struggling Americans are not large enough.
I am asking Congress to amend this bill and increase the ridiculously low $600 to $2,000, or $4,000 for a couple.
An increase to the size of the checks was something Democrats attempted to get, but Republicans refused to accept it, throwing it further into doubt the future of any imminent financial relief for millions of struggling Americans. However, the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi plans to hold a vote to approve the $2,000 checks on Monday. Another objection made by Trump was that the bill gives too much money to special interests, cultural projects, and foreign aid.
$600 for the past several months that Americans haven't received any assistance is almost nothing. It's $1.75 a day. It's quite pathetic, especially when you look at how the rest of the bill gives millions of dollars. It gives $33 million to Juan Guaido. It gives millions of dollars to Israel to regime change measures. And this $600 essentially is going to go to landlords. It's going to go to banks. Americans are going to see that money and it will be gone in the next moment.
Trump's refusal to sign the bill is not just affecting jobless benefits. The partial government shutdown will begin on Tuesday, unless Congress can agree a stopgap government funding bill before then. The U.S. president's move surprised many, particularly since Trump left nearly all of the negotiations to Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, who made no push for the $2,000 stimulus checks that the U.S. president is now seeking. All through the months-long wrangling between Democrats and Republicans over the stimulus package, Trump did not say anything. He didn't object to the terms of the deal before Congress voted it through on Monday. But since then, Trump has constantly complained about it. If he continues to refuse to sign the bill, more than 14 million laid-off Americans could lose their unemployment benefits for weeks. Even if Trump finally agrees to sign it, they would likely suffer a break in payments. States cannot pay out benefits for weeks that begin before the bill is signed. Now, as a result of Trump's refusal to sign the bill, benefits will not restart until the first week of January, but they will still end in mid-March, effectively trimming the extension to 10 weeks from 11. Moreover, a series of additional relief provisions, including an eviction moratorium, are set to expire at the end of the month. Other temporary relief protections shielding millions of Americans from the brunt of the pandemic's economic toll will lapse shortly after the new year without action. Top officials, including Pelosi and Mnuchin, are now privately discussing plans such as a stopgap spending bill in case Trump formally vetoes the measures by Monday. But it is not clear how long that stopgap measure would last or whether Trump would sign it if it makes none of the changes that he wanted. Trump never said that he would veto the legislation anyway. However, he may not have to. The legislation passed with the support of, well, more than two-thirds of both the House and the Senate, easily surpassing the threshold required to override a veto if he actually did that.
It appears to be a partisan divide. Now Trump is saying he won't sign the stimulus package because it's too low. But we also have to look at the fact that when this bill was signed, it was signed with a supermajority in both houses, in both the House of Representatives and in the Senate. And we gotta also remember that the Democrats now have the majority in the House of Representatives. So because they had two-thirds in both the House of Representatives and the Senate, it really doesn't matter if Trump refuses to sign it or not. Of course, the Congress would hope that Trump signs it and that they can get it done, but they could still veto his veto.
But in this scenario, timing means everything. The legislation can become law 10 days after the bill is enrolled, even without a presidential signature. But because the time frame overlaps with the end of the current Congress in January the 3rd and the convening of the 117th Congress, some called a pocket veto can become a possibility. A pocket veto is a legislative maneuver that allows the U.S. president or another official with veto power to exercise that power over a bill by taking no action instead of affirmatively vetoing it. If that happens, all legislation dies with Congress. So without Trump's signature in the next 10 days, the bill would have to be reintroduced and voted on a second time. This means more delay in funding of the government and providing relief to struggling Americans and businesses.
Yemen is currently the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe. Yemeni people are facing a long list of unbearable problems such as daily airstrikes, famine-like conditions, different deadly diseases, and an economy in tatters. Meanwhile, Yemeni children are undoubtedly the most vulnerable part of the population. The situation of children in Yemen has been described as a crisis within a broader humanitarian catastrophe. This week, Yemen's health minister once again raised the alarm about the situation of children in his country. Taha al-Mutawakkil said 3,800 children have been killed in attacks carried out by the Saudis and their allies over the past years. He also warned that the aggressors' bombardment campaign has devastated Yemen's health infrastructure, making it increasingly difficult to save children. The plight of the Yemeni kids has once again come under the spotlight just a few months before the sixth anniversary of the beginning of the Saudi-led military offensive against Yemen. Earlier this month, the United Nations Children's Fund said one Yemeni child dies every 10 minutes from a preventable disease, 2 million are out of school, and thousands have been killed or maimed since 2015. The United Nations has been quite loud in voicing concern about the ongoing crisis, but it is also under fire for removing the Saudi-led coalition this year from a blacklist of child killers. The Saudi-led alliance was first blacklisted several years ago for killing and injuring children in the war.
The United Nations, of course, has this very typical, very endemic weakness, I dare say, being that it's an organization that for a big part is dependent on the world superpowers to really take action. And we've seen in the past that for this reason, it is very difficult sometimes for the United Nations to really come into action, even when a lot of the member states might want to. We have enormous pressure from Saudi Arabia.
It was on March 25th, 2015, when Saudi Arabia and its allies, such as the United Arab Emirates, began pounding Yemen from air, sea, and ground. Now another anniversary of the beginning of the offensive is drawing close with no end in sight to the campaign. Why is this war dragging on so long, and why is the international community failing to put an end to it? The invaders launched a bloody offensive in the hope of achieving a quick victory. However, to this day, none of the stated goals of the military campaign have been met, with the Saudi-led onslaught being described as a fiasco. But the invaders are not changing course. They have indiscriminately bombarded civilian areas. Markets, funerals, weddings, jails, medical and water supply facilities have all been hit. This has taken a heavy toll on Yemen's infrastructure and civilian population. Western countries, particularly the United States and Britain, have refused to review their ties with Saudi Arabia over the bloodshed in Yemen. They have instead intensified their backing of Al Saud. The United States and Britain have stepped up their arms sales to the regime despite the human suffering in Yemen. Meanwhile, the United States has provided the Saudi and Emirati forces with different types of military assistance. Critics insist the heavy U.S. military support has made America a partner to the devastating war. Observers believe without Western diplomatic and military support, the onslaught would have ended a very long time ago.
Rabbi English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to Rabbi English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Rabbi English Radio.
A new investigation has found that the Trump administration has awarded contracts to build a border wall between the U.S. and Mexico on land that it does not yet own. This tactic has led to millions of dollars in delay costs. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Sharon Zhang, writer. This article is published under the heading, "The Trump administration is trying to build the border wall on land it doesn't own." Here's the details of this article. A new investigation has found that the Trump administration has awarded contracts to build a border wall between the U.S. and Mexico on land that it does not yet own. This tactic has led to millions of dollars in delay costs. The investigation, produced jointly by ProPublica and the Texas Tribune, finds that in many places where the government does not yet own the land, the agency has used the argument, often successfully, to convince even dubious federal judges to immediately seize land from property owners, fighting their eminent domain cases at least 24 times. These cases have caused some frustration among the judges hearing them. The publications report that the U.S. government forcing timelines unnecessarily. The court has repeatedly expressed its dissatisfaction with the United States' request for expedited relief, one district judge wrote. The United States is not entitled to expedited relief and should cease requesting such relief without good cause. former senior counsel for President Barack Obama's State Department, Austin Evers, told ProPublica and the Texas Tribune that because of the Trump administration receiving penalties over signing contracts for land it can't yet contract out, American taxpayers are seeing their money thrown away for no purpose because the government signed the contract before it could execute the project. In some places, delays have been adding costs of as much as $100,000 per day. As the Texas Civil Rights Project points out on Twitter, at least one family may have their property built on before they receive just compensation under eminent domain. The government filed to have a judge grant them the property immediately, but if they continue as they have, they may start building even before the property has been granted, the organization pointed out. The border wall has cost billions more than initially anticipated. Republicans fought for even more funding in the latest COVID stimulus package and got $1.4 billion, down from $2 billion Trump had requested. And yet, while the stimulus was delayed for several months due to many back-and-forth negotiations, a part of many Republican objections to the package was how much the bill would cost. Several Republicans, such as Senators Ted Cruz of Texas and Ron Paul of Kentucky, voted against the stimulus for that reason, though economists say that it's normal for the government to engage in deficit spending when there is an economic emergency such as the COVID-induced recession. On the other hand, if Biden holds construction on the border wall, as he has vowed to do, not another foot he promised in August, the government would save an estimated $2.6 billion, according to the Pentagon. At current rates of expenditure, there has been about $15 billion tied up in building 738 miles, which comes out to about $20 million a mile. Also, according to reports by Center for Biological Diversity, the border wall threatens 2,134,792 acres of critical habitat and 93 endangered or candidate species, including Mexican gray wolves and crino checkerpot butterflies. For species such as the Cactus phoraginus pygmy owl, which tends to fly low, the wall will isolate birds in Mexico from populations in the U.S., preventing breeding and heightening the possibility of extinction.
Around the World with Reporters.
This is the first ever Iranian-made coronavirus vaccine that has made its way to human trials. It's called COVID-1. Produced by Iranian biotech firm Shifa Farm, the vaccine was tested on 3 volunteers during a ceremony attended by Iran's health officials.
Today is a very promising day for all Iranians. Today we reap the strenuous efforts of our experts and researchers who work tirelessly to produce this vaccine. We are already setting up the needed infrastructure for the mass production of this vaccine to kick off its production at a large scale as soon as it clears all of the human trials.
Some 60,000 people signed up to get the jab after a call for volunteers issued by the health ministry. Out of this number, 56 people were confirmed for the first stage of the human trials. The approved volunteers will receive 2 shots within 2 weeks. The results will be announced roughly a month after the second shot. The first person who received the vaccine was the daughter of this man, who was in charge of the project to develop a local vaccine. He says this was meant to prove to all Iranians that the local vaccine is safe.
I want to send this message that I care about the health of my people the same way as I care about my children. The second message is that I, as a leader of this project, I'm 100% certain about the effectiveness and the safety of this vaccine.
Iran is working on 7 other local vaccines, each using a different technology for immunization against the virus. But none has so far cleared animal trials. CovIran uses a coronavirus that is weakened or killed by chemicals, similar to how polio immunizations work. Leading Western vaccines like Pfizer use newer, less proven technologies to target the coronavirus's spike protein using RNA. Iranian experts say their vaccine has an edge over its rivals. CovIran does not need to be kept in ultra-low temperatures, an issue that Pfizer is grappling with.
This vaccine, they don't need any special refrigeration. In a normal refrigerator, we can do it. And you know that our primary health care in Iran is very, very good. And maybe a lot of other countries, they don't have a primary health care. In primary health care, we are able to vaccinate very soon most of the people.
CovIran will be tested on at least 10,000 volunteers before getting the approval of the health ministry to hit the market. Health officials expect that the process will take a few months. Until then, Iranian authorities need to import foreign-made vaccines to inoculate their citizens. But U.S. sanctions are a barrier. The embargoes do not directly target Iran's medical industry. But due to banking restrictions, the country cannot transfer money to any international medical firm, which would sell its products to Iran.
Experts here say their concerns about the sanctions have acted as a catalyst that helped catapult them to the human trial phase ahead of the set deadline. Now as the Iranian vaccine is inching closer to the market, hopes are revived that Iranians will no longer have to worry about the American barriers that block their access to foreign vaccines. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
These days, Lebanon is hosting various events marking the first anniversary of the martyrdom of Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. This book reads, "The Man Who Vanquished America," will be out in bookstores on the martyrdom anniversary on January 3rd. The author tells Press TV he started writing after the martyrdom of General Qasem Soleimani in January 2020, and the main inspiration for him was the personality of the man who changed the region and even the world.
This man is the man, in terms of strategy, is the man of the century. The United States could not beat him. On the contrary, he defeated the United States in many posts, in many positions, in many places, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Iran, and in Syria, in Lebanon, in Yemen, in Palestine. So he outsmarted them.
One of the main discernments of deep study of the assassination of General Soleimani was that the will of the resistance will be more adamant on removing the U.S. hegemonic presence from the region.
Achieved nothing. They killed the freedom in their mind when they killed Haj Qasem Soleimani. They killed justice in their mind and in their people when they killed Haj Qasem Soleimani. On the contrary, Haj Qasem Soleimani now is living in every person or a thinker who think that Haj Qasem Soleimani represents such slogans, freedom, justice, and liberty.
U.S. Army generals and strategists, as well as those who grieved him, agree that the commander of the Quds Force brought the people of West Asia together and made the cause of fighting U.S. oppression a united struggle. Other virtual events to commemorate the memory of the Iranian commander were held by a group of activists in the form of Lebanese traditional storytelling. Through this art form, the writers tried to narrate to the people of Lebanon the story of Commander Qasem Soleimani and his significant role in thwarting U.S. plots.
The biggest shock was when the U.S. Army General Petraeus read a message which read, "I am Qasem Soleimani, the commander of Al-Quds forces. I am the one who conducts the Iranian policies in Iraq, Afghanistan, Gaza, and the entire region. And the Iranian ambassador in Iran is a member of the Quds force."
Many in the region who knew General Qasem Soleimani or learned about him after his martyrdom say they have no doubt that his martyrdom and the deeds done during his lifetime will lead to a complete liberation of the region. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The rollout of COVID-19 vaccines across Europe began this weekend. Healthcare workers and the elderly are getting the jab first. EU leaders have negotiated contracts for more than 2 billion vaccine doses from various suppliers. The first 200 million are the Pfizer and BioNTech vaccine.
It was important for me to get vaccinated in order to protect myself, to protect my family, and to be a part of the solution to stop the pandemic.
I felt honored to get the vaccine, and lucky, because I can finally feel more protected. What gives me relief is the prospect that after such a difficult and challenging period, we will finally get to see the light at the end of the tunnel.
The EU had planned the rollout to begin in unison across the bloc Sunday, but Hungary, Germany and Slovakia couldn't wait and began vaccinating on Saturday. The Netherlands says it won't start vaccinating until January 8th. The start of the EU's vaccine rollout comes after a more infectious COVID-19 variant was detected in the UK, which led to dozens of countries closing their borders to UK citizens.
Only if countries are looking and testing effectively will you be able to pick up variants and adjust strategies to cope. We must ensure that countries are not punished for transparently sharing new scientific findings.
The new variant has been detected in several EU countries as well. But vaccine developers say they expect their shots to work against COVID-19 mutations. More than 600,000 vulnerable people have already been vaccinated in the UK, which started administering the Pfizer jab 2.5 weeks ago. But ministers warn the country must double its vaccination target to 2 million a week in order to avoid a third wave.
I think it's an incredibly serious, incredibly dangerous moment. I think all of us always felt that January was going to become very hard and that we were heading into a very hard winter and hospital leave was being cancelled and ITUs were being got ready. And yet, nevertheless, I feel like we weren't ready for something quite as severe as this feels with the sheer level of caseload and the added effect of the variant virus building up our R number and making things so much harder than we expected.
The UK hopes to expand its vaccination programme with the rollout of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, which is expected on January 4th. There are now more COVID-19 patients in hospitals in England than there were during the peak of the first wave, and more than 71,000 Britons have died of the virus. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The Israeli regime has been intensifying its moves in the region as media revelations suggest it is intending to build a military base on the Yemeni island of Socotra. Yemen's Supreme Political Council has condemned these suspicious moves, promising Israel a decisive response in case it commits any stupidity against the Yemenis.
The Israeli move is not new, as it is running the region through some puppet regimes. The Yemeni position is clear as it was 6 years ago. We are in the midst of a war launched by Saudi Arabia with the tacit backing of American and Zionist regimes.
The Israeli media have boasted the arrival of the submarine to the Bab al-Mandab Strait after crossing the Suez Canal. An Israeli military spokesman also confirmed the move, claiming the step was taken to counter smart drones Iran could potentially launch from Yemen or Iraq.
The presence of Israeli entities in the Yemeni territorial waters dates back to the beginning of the Saudi-led aggression. It was just a year ago. There were plenty of statements by some Arab rulers pledging to stop what they claimed the Iranian expansion in the region. However, the same rulers are silent on the Israeli agenda. They have not only normalized their ties with the regime, but allow its submarines pass through the Red Sea.
It seems that the Yemeni army's possession of missile systems capable of reaching as far as Eilat has become a nightmare for Israel and its cronies. Tel Aviv knows that it will not be immune to the Yemeni retaliation. However, sending one of its submarines is yet another provocative move by Israel to set the region on fire.
Israel is still using Iran as a pretext for its interventions in the region that, despite the exposure of its agenda, especially in Yemen, which is suffering from a war led by Saudi Arabia, but was actually jointly hatched by some Arab regimes and their backers in Washington and Tel Aviv. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have expressed gratitude to Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani 1 year after his assassination by U.S. forces in the Iraqi capital, Baghdad. Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani played a major role in strengthening Palestinian resistance movements against the Israeli regime.
We commemorate the first anniversary of the martyrdom of the great commander Haj Qasem Soleimani, who died for the sake of Jerusalem al-Quds. This anniversary comes amid great pressures on the resistance in the region. On this occasion, we vow to follow in the footsteps of the commander to liberate Palestine.
Following the assassination of General Soleimani, Palestinians held several events to pay tribute to the late Iranian commander. They considered him as a hero for Palestine and Jerusalem al-Quds.
On the anniversary of the martyrdom of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, we express our great gratitude for sacrifices he made for the sake of oppressed Palestinians.
The assassination of General Soleimani on Donald Trump's orders has sent shockwaves across the West Asia. Soleimani's memory continues to live in the hearts and minds of Palestinians in the blockaded Gaza Strip.
Palestinians will continue to remain steadfast and condemn the treason by some Arab countries that have normalized ties with the Zionist regime. On this occasion, Palestinians also vow to fight the occupation until regaining their freedom.
Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was assassinated in a U.S. airstrike on January 3rd.
Palestinians say Martyr Qasem Soleimani has sacrificed his life for the sake of Palestine and Jerusalem al-Quds and has always supported Palestinian resistance against the Zionist regime. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Ahead of the first anniversary of the assassination of the former commander of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, General Qasem Soleimani, people are now holding commemoration ceremonies to pay respect to this late Iranian icon. We went to the city of Qom, where a movement called Resistance Youth Front is formed to support the cause of General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, who defeated the ominous phenomenon of Daesh. Scholars, youth, activists, and resistance movement supporters from countries like Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and India attended the ceremony to tell the world that General Soleimani's cause will not be forgotten.
It's a great pleasure for all of us, for all the people of the world who are free, who just think freely, okay? So, such kind of attribution actually led us to not only memorize or recall their memory, actually also to follow their path. That is the path of humanity. That is the real war on terror, war against terror.
Shahid Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, they fight for saving the life of all mankind, of all Muslim and non-Muslim.
General Qasem Soleimani was assassinated by a U.S. strike on January 3rd last year when he was on an official visit to the Iraqi capital, Baghdad. Hitting his convoy, the assault also led to the death of many others, including Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, deputy commander of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Units, or Hashd al-Shaabi.
Apart from the ceremony held here, within the coming days, a number of other events will be held across Iran under health protocols to pay tribute to General Qasem Soleimani. Human Abedi, Qom.
Afghans are a nation with a long history of resistance against various enemies. Since 19th century, Afghanistan has been invaded by different armies. The Colonial Army of Britain, the Red Army of the Soviet Union, and the Black Army of Terrorism, along with its international backers. They all tried to break the will of Afghans. As experts say, the existence of a resistance spirit among Afghans has helped them to make contacts with other resistance figures beyond the Afghan borders. Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was one such figure who was interested in having ties with anti-terrorism and anti-hegemony resistance movements, mainly across the Middle East and some other Asian countries, including Afghanistan.
Lieutenant General Soleimani was popular in many societies like Afghanistan. He was a charismatic leader who fought terrorism and helped many oppressed nations to strongly stand against terrorism.
Many others also believe that the charismatic personality of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani revives for Afghans the memory of Afghanistan's national hero, Ahmad Shah Massoud. It becomes more interesting when you understand that both Soleimani and Massoud had friendly ties before Massoud's assassination, only 2 days ahead of the 9/11 attacks.
Lieutenant General Soleimani had a transnational personality. He had close ties and cooperation with our national hero Ahmad Shah Massoud and Professor Rabbani, who were leading anti-terrorism resistance in northern Afghanistan.
Let's not forget that many here in Afghanistan believe the slaying of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, who was leading regional resistance against terrorists, is not an endpoint in the fight against terror. Rather, his assassination has made the resistance front all the more determined in its campaign against terrorists. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The first person vaccinated against COVID-19 in Austria, an 84-year-old pensioner who says she wants to see her children, grandchildren and great-grandchildren again without hesitation. The first 5 volunteers who received the initial doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine included 3 elderly patients with underlying health conditions and 2 healthcare personnel. According to the manufacturer, a certain protective effect should already exist 7 days after the first of the 2 doses is injected. Chancellor Sebastian Kurz and Health Minister Rudolf Anschober, who were present for the vaccinations at Vienna's Medical University, spoke of a historic day.
This is the beginning of the victory against a pandemic and a game changer. We move to normalcy step by step with every vaccination that is carried out.
But the two officials warned of challenging months ahead.
Today marks a turning point, but the fight against the coronavirus has not yet been won.
Anschober said that by the summer, over 4 million doses of the vaccine would be available in Austria, which has a population of almost 9 million. The vaccination is expected to be rolled out in 3 phases, starting with those in high-risk groups, over 80-year-olds and medical personnel, in the first few weeks of January, and continuing with frontline workers. And from April, the rest of the population, excluding those under the age of 16. Austria entered into its 3rd hard lockdown on Saturday, with the Chancellor warning against a 3rd corona wave and a massive increase in infection numbers across Europe.
Officials have made it clear that another year of recurring lockdowns is not an option. The hope is that with more vaccinations, that can be avoided. Homolezki, Vienna.
On International Day of Epidemic Preparedness, Gaza's health sector continues to suffer due to the Israeli blockade. Coronavirus infections have skyrocketed in the Gaza Strip, which is one of the world's most densely populated areas. Despite the increasing number of COVID-19 infections, the Israeli regime continues to place tight restrictions on the entry of humanitarian supplies, including medicines and hospital equipment. Human rights organizations say Israel's illegal practices have compounded the risk of coronavirus infection for nearly 2 million Palestinians, making it extremely difficult to combat the deadly pandemic.
The Israeli blockade has taken its toll on all aspects of life in Gaza, and especially on the health sector. The health sector is suffering from an unprecedented deterioration due to lack of medicines and medical supplies, as well as trained medical personnel to deal with the coronavirus pandemic.
The coronavirus pandemic has complicated the already dire humanitarian situation in the blockaded Gaza Strip. The Israeli blockade and multiple wars since 2007 have had a devastating impact on the well-being of people in the tiny coastal sliver.
Our people are suffering because of the Zionist blockade under the watchful eye of the international community. The situation has only gotten worse amid the coronavirus pandemic.
As infections continue to rise, experts are calling for the complete lifting of the Israeli blockade to help fight the spread of the coronavirus.
The humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip is catastrophic and is getting worse by the day. The health sector is unable to provide proper medical care to coronavirus patients and even struggles to provide tests for the deadly virus. Gaza has a population of over 2 million and hospitals don't have enough beds for the patients.
The COVID-19 pandemic remains a serious concern due to the capacity gaps in the enclave's health system.
Hospitals in the tiny enclave lack medical facilities and medicines to tackle the deadly virus due to years of Israeli blockade. Israeli inhumane practices have battered Gaza's health sector since 2007. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The article you're about to hear has been authored by Lisa Grossman, a writer on science and astronomy. The article is titled "Astronomers Spotted Colliding Neutron Stars That May Have Formed a Magnetar." Please stay with us for more of Lisa Grossman's article. surprisingly bright cosmic blast might have marked the birth of a magnetar. If so, it would be the first time that astronomers have witnessed the formation of this kind of rapidly spinning, extremely magnetized stellar corp. The dazzling flash of light was made when two neutron stars collided and merged into one massive object, astronomers report in an upcoming issue of the Astrophysical Journal. Though the specially bright light could mean that a magnetar was produced, other explanations are also possible, researchers say. Astrophysicist Wenfei Fong of Northwestern University in Evanston and colleagues first spotted the site of the neutron star crash as a burst of gamma-ray light detected with NASA's orbiting New Gera's SWIFT observatory on 22nd of May this year. Follow-up observations in X-ray, visible and infrared wavelengths of light showed that the gamma-ray bursts were accompanied by a characteristic glow called a kilonova. Kilonovas are thought to form after two neutron stars, the ultra-dense cores of dead stars, collide and merge. The merger sprays neutron-rich material, not seen anywhere else in the universe, around the collision site, Fong says. That material quickly produces unstable heavy elements, and those elements soon decay, heating the neutron cloud and making it glow in optical and infrared wavelengths. Astronomers think that kilonovas form every time a pair of neutron stars merge. But mergers produce other, brighter light as well, which can swamp the kilonova signal. As a result, astronomers have seen only one definitive kilonova before, in August of 2017, though there are other potential candidates. The glow that Wenfei Fong's team saw, however, put the 2017 kilonova to shame. It's potentially the most luminous kilonova that we've ever seen, she says. It basically breaks our understanding of the luminosities and brightnesses that kilonovas are supposed to have. The biggest difference in brightness was in infrared light, measured by the Hubble Space Telescope about 3 and 16 days after the gamma ray burst. The light was 10 times as bright as infrared light seen in previous neutron star mergers. That was the real eye-opening moment, and that's when we scrambled to find an explanation, Fong says. We had to come up with an extra source of energy that was boosting the kilonova. Her favorite explanation is that the crash produced a magnetar, which is a type of neutron star. Normally, when neutron stars merge, the mega neutron star that they produce is too heavy to survive. Almost immediately, the star succumbs to intense gravitational forces and produces a black hole. But if the supermassive neutron star is spinning rapidly and is highly magnetically charged, in other words, is a magnetar, it could save itself from collapsing. Both the support of its own rotation and dumping energy and thus some mass into the surrounding neutron-rich cloud could keep the star from turning into a black hole, the researchers have suggested. That extra energy in turn would make the cloud give off more light, the extra infrared glow that the Hubble Space Telescope spotted. There are other possible explanations for the extra bright light, Wenfei Fong says. If the colliding neutron stars produced a black hole, that black hole could have launched a jet of charged plasma moving at nearly the speed of light. The details of how the jet interacts with the neutron-rich materials surrounding the collision site could also explain the extra kilonova glow, she says. If a magnetar was produced, that could tell us something about the stability of neutron stars and how massive they can get, Fong says. We don't know the maximum mass of neutron stars, but we do know that in